warahmatullahi wabarakatuh, and a very, very good evening to everybody here. Welcome to the Muslim Feminist event organized by the Malaysian Progressive United Kingdom. My name is Nawal. I am the MC for today. I am a second year international relations student at the London School of Economics. And today, I'm also a member of MPUK. MPUK strives to make students matter. And we are a small group of Malaysian students, both undergrad and postgrad. We are committed to encouraging students to talk about politics in a more open and free manner. So today, we believe that gender is also a very, very much a dimension of politics. So today we decided to talk about two very important ideologies, Islam and feminism. So this course is intended to poke through the very complicated idea of feminism and also its compatibility with Islam. And so it's two very talked about ideologies, and lately there's been a lot of discussions on whether they can coexist or are they purely conflicting ideologies. So we decided to invite two very smart, very intelligent, very young women to talk about these issues, and these two people have been very, very vocal on this topic. So the first one is Zahra Faris. She is a part of the Muslim Debate Initiative. She has talked extensively about liberalism and feminism, and she's also an alumnus of SOAS.
Chair.
The next speaker is Datin Paduka Marina Mahade. She is an advocate of feminism within an Islamic framework. She is also very active in humanitarian efforts such as HIV/AIDS, and also she's a board member of the Sisters in Islam Malaysia. Our moderator for today is the manager of gender in MPUK, Izzati Badro. She is the mastermind of this project. She has orchestrated and planned this project for many, many months. So I hope that today she has a lot of very interesting questions in store. Before we go on to the discussion, the format for today's event is 10 minutes introductory speech each, followed by about 30 minutes or so for the moderator to pose her questions. After a 5-minute short break, there will be an extensive Q&A session where anybody can come up and ask anything. And there will be a post-event informal chat with the speakers, so if you like to talk personally to them, then you can stay back after the event. Okay? Just like technical things, the prayer room is right beside this hall. The bathroom is downstairs, and it would be really, really nice if everybody silent or mute their phone or just turn it off so it doesn't disturb the flow of the event. Alright.
Thank you, Nawal, for the warm introduction. I'm just not going to use the mic because it disturbs the audio video recording. So I'm just going to project my voice. Okay, thank you, Nawal, for the introduction, the warm introduction. Just to note, Nawal is also the manager of sociology of MPUK. We have a section on the MPUK. So if anyone wants to talk to her, please do so. It has come to my attention that compatibility or conflicting ideas of Islam and feminism should be discussed in a mature setting. Islamic feminism, a phenomenon that derives internally with no obvious West or East fault line, appeared firstly in the countries where patriarchal Islamism is exercised widely. However, why do we need feminism if Islam is inherently self-correcting? To what extent does Islam and feminism agree with each other? This topic unbolted a lot, a plethora of questions that many of us in this room keen to know. Hence, without further ado, I would just allow Datin Paduka Marina Mahdi to give her introductory remark, and then followed by some comments. Yeah. Are you okay with projecting first? Or
I hope so. Good evening, everyone.
If you want to stand.
Oh, I see.
Or do you prefer?
No, I'll just sit here. Yeah, fine. good evening, everyone. First of all, let me thank MPUK for inviting me to come and speak at this session. It's really great to have this opportunity because the Malaysian students here will know at home I will never have this opportunity because, you know, I'm not allowed into any of the public universities. So if any of you came from any of the public universities in Malaysia, it's great to see you. for some reason, they all think I'm really dangerous. I don't know. I just want to start by saying that, you know, I'm not a scholar. So if you're expecting a lecture where you can take notes for exams or whatever, I'm not the person. But I have had more than 20 years of experience working in the NGO field. In HIV/AIDS particularly, and that experience is really has shaped the way I view things back home particularly, but also on the general issue of women's rights and particularly in Islam. So let me talk to you a bit about the experience that has shaped my thinking. So as you know, I was president of the Malaysian AIDS Council for 12 years. Actually, it's been 10 years since I stepped down from there, but some people still think I'm president of MAC. But one of the things that I learned during those 12 years, working in a country like Malaysia, where most people are pretty religious, is that you cannot separate religion, you cannot neglect religion in our work for prevention, treatment, care, and support. And you think that this would be obvious to a lot of people, but it wasn't actually. I remember going to lots of international meetings where I would talk about, you know, let's bring religious leaders into the work with HIV, and was met with very, very vehement opposition, mostly from people coming from countries such as the Middle East or from Latin America. And I used to be very puzzled by all this, you know. I realized that those countries really are quite patriarchal countries, very difficult, where they had a lot of problems with the church or problems with the religious authorities there. So never mind, Malaysia is Malaysia, we can, you know, we don't have to follow other people. So I thought that, you know, religious leaders had a big role to play in HIV, particularly to prevent the stigma and discrimination that people living with HIV suffered. So to cut a long story short, we actually did a lot of work, we at MAC, did a lot of work in collaboration with people like JAKIM, the Islamic Development Department, in the Prime Minister's Department, where we went around the country training a lot of religious leaders on HIV. And religious leaders, meaning everyone from imams, qadis, ketua kampung, you know, village heads who very often had to minister to villagers and all that on HIV. So we went to train them on HIV/AIDS and found really good response. One, because they were already experiencing it at the ground level and they didn't know what to do. So doing this work around the country, we worked with JAKIM to develop a manual on Islam and AIDS, which brought in a lot of religious arguments for prevention, for care, for compassion, for support, for, you know, not stigmatizing and discriminating against people living with HIV. And it was a very, you know, it was a long process of working with all these religious leaders. And for me, it was a very enlightening experience, because my instinct that we had to bring in religious leaders was correct. We had to bring them in because they could do so much good. And what was enlightening for me is that we could, unlike those people that I met at overseas conferences, religion could be a very positive force for the work that we did, right? So that was one. So, there was one specific problem though that wasn't quite settled by the way we work, and that was the problem with women who were vulnerable to HIV. Most women in Malaysia, I mean, if any of you remember that, in Malaysia, the HIV problem was mostly among drug users, who are mostly men, and who are mostly, sadly, Malay and Muslim. So their wives and partners were at particular risk of infection through sexual transmission from them, right? So we found that there was a really very specific problem in protecting these women from HIV, or in reducing their vulnerability to HIV. And it was not just about giving them information. Information you can give, you know, how do you get HIV, how do you not get HIV, but how do they act on it, right? What could, you know, what's the point of talking to them about condoms? Because very often the people they are most at risk at was their own husbands. And how do you bring up this question without really creating a huge problem and possibly putting yourself at risk of being beaten up? Yeah. And how do you talk to them about abstinence? You can't talk to them about abstinence, they're married, right? So we had a lot of cases where these women would be running back to their mothers saying, you know, I'm really afraid I might get infected. My husband, I know, is on drugs. What do I do? And the mothers would say, no, you have to go back because you have to obey your husband. You know, you can't say no to him. Now, I'm very sure that these mothers, if they knew the risk and if they knew what HIV meant, they would not so easily say that to their daughters, which just goes to show that you should educate everyone about HIV regardless of their actual risk. But this was a problem. This was a big problem for a lot of the women that we met. How do you protect them? So this is what. So I got to thinking, like, were these women doomed? Are these beliefs about their relationship with their husbands, is that correct? Or is there room to maneuver with this? So just as, you know, when we work with JAKIM to find, like, religious justifications for prevention, treatment, care, support, and all that, in doing that manual, where we found a lot of Quranic verses and things like that, I started to think like, okay, how can we protect these women from a religious point of view? Like, how do we counter this? And that's really how I became a Muslim feminist. Because I believe that if these Muslim women were made vulnerable by what they believe Islam said about how they should act with their husbands, then there was a problem. And I didn't believe that God would do that to women, like just purposely make them unable to protect themselves. That somehow didn't ring true to me because of what I believe about Islam. So with the help of various Islamic scholars, Prof. Hashim Kamali was one, Prof. Fatih Osman was one, we started to think about and reading various publications, reading those published by my colleagues at CIS, I came to two conclusions. One was that the Quran is a wonderfully liberating book. Because if you read it, and you for yourself particularly, it talks about, it emphasizes justice and equality over and over again. And so one of my favorite verses, it says that men and women are clones of each other, which means we protect each other. So how does that gel with men, you know, not caring about infecting their wives, for instance? You know, how is that protection? So that can't be right. So how can it be just if women were left to the mercy of infection from their own husbands? And if the Quran says that every man and woman is entitled to, has a right to bodily integrity, to dignity and all that, how can we, you know, just because of biology and just that they women have to be left to be infected? So this was one. Of course, men who are infected also deserve treatment, care, and support. I'm not arguing about that. But women very often suffered more from the stigma. Just a brief thing, you know, very often women found they were infected through HIV tests when they are pregnant, because we have a prevention of mother-to-child treatment program. And very often, you know, they are found to be pregnant, found to be infected first. And very often it's because they were infected by the husband, but the husband had not been tested yet. So very often, they were blamed for the infection. And we know lots of women have been thrown out of their families and everything because they were tested first. So that was a big issue. And secondly, if to be a feminist is to care about women's issues, not just about HIV, but also about violence against women, and laws and policies that discriminate against women at work, at home, in the courts, then the solutions for me can be found in the Quran. So what is needed, however, is for women to reclaim the right to find the answers in the Quran by themselves and not through others, especially if the others are men. Because I really think that the Quran's principles and ethics are for all time. And we have to, and it can respond to every situation, but not literally. It came in a certain time, meant to respond to certain situations at the time, but the situation has changed. So the question is, how can we apply the Quranic principles of justice and equality to the situation of Muslim women today? And I think we can, and that's why I think Islam and feminism are completely compatible. So I think I'll stop there first and let Zahra have a say, and then we can carry on. Because I have a lot more to say about that. That's just, in brief, the story of how I came to this position.
You can stand on.
Oh, sure.
Now we're going to proceed with Zahra Faris with the introduction.
Thank you. Okay, first of all, assalamu alaikum and greetings to everybody for coming, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me. I begin in the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. Now, the title of this evening is Islam and Feminism, Compatible or Conflicting? First of all, can everybody hear me at the back?
Yes.
Okay, great, thank you. Now, the mere fact that some people decide to call themselves Muslim feminists is not really proof that Islam and feminism are compatible. And one of the greatest ironies, perhaps, is that such feminists regularly affirm through their own work that feminism and Islam are not compatible unless Islam changes to fit feminist ideas. Now, some feminist groups, like Sisters in Islam and Musawa, instead of reviving Islam, often you find them demanding reinterpretations, repudiations, or the reformation of Islam in order to actually align it with Western secular liberal beliefs. Now, for example, they openly advocate the cherry-picking of prophetic traditions that they like, i.e. hadith, and rejecting those they don't like. So Keisha Ali, for example, some of you may have heard of her, she claims that contemporary believers are permitted to adopt hadith when it agrees with contemporary Western ethics, but to reject it when it contradicts them. So there's this cherry-picking going on. Aisha Chowdhury, in one of Musawa's publications, justifies rejecting hadith that they do not like by stating that the Prophet, peace be upon him, was a patriarchal man who belonged and was comfortable in 7th century Arabia. And she asks readers to take advantage of the pliable nature of prophetic reports. And when it comes to Quranic interpretations, some of you may have heard of Amina Wadud and Asma Lam Rabit. They also outrageously argue that the Islamic injunction for a wife to obey her husband in what is halal, obviously not in that particular circumstances which you referred to, contradicts the oneness of God, as they claim that obedience is for God alone. Now, if obedience to the husband is idolatry, then according to such feminists, a boy obeying his mother would also be idolatry. A citizen being a law-abiding person would also be idolatry. And a Muslim obeying the Prophet, peace be upon him, which the Quran specifically requires, would also be idolatry. Now, Amina Wadud, who is a founding member of Sisters in Islam, she went even further when she infamously said with regards to Quranic text, personally, I'm quoting, she says, personally, I've come to places where how the text says what it says is just plain inadequate or unacceptable, however much interpretation is enacted upon it. And she says further that when she disagrees with the Quranic text, she says, there is the possibility of refuting the text to talk back to even say no. So does this sound like feminists themselves think that Islam and feminism are compatible? Doesn't really sound like it. Now, they also claim, for example, that gender roles do not exist in Islam because of the principle of equality or musawa. Now, interestingly, the Quran doesn't actually use the word musawa or any of its derived forms, except when it's saying not equal our belief and disbelief. This is the only instance in which you'll find that this term used. Rather, the Quran recognizes that no two people, regardless of gender, are given the same provisions, blessings, or tests, and in the afterlife, similarly, people are ranked and rewarded differently. So people are treated with and promised justice in the Quran, not a blanket equality. It's not proposing a kind of communism. But due to its somewhat shallow thinking and assessing the worth of individuals in materialistic terms, what feminism ends up doing is dehumanizing the very sophisticated Islamic injunctions in the Quran that relate to family and marriage. And whilst it advocates intersectionality in diagnosing problems, it fails to appreciate the interconnectedness and the checks and balances that actually exist within the Sharia itself. And its individualistic worldview means it fails to look beyond the individual and appreciate the foresight that the Sharia has in preventing certain injustices. Now, this means that feminists who need to argue that Islam is male biased cannot really explain why in Islam a woman has a right over her husband's time, his money, and even his body. And so they cannot therefore also accept the Islamic rulings on inheritance, spousal obligations, rulings on family leadership, modesty, and so on. And by constantly demanding that Islam has to change, feminists are openly admitting that it is not compatible with Islam. So it's not me saying it, this is feminists saying it. But what exactly do they want Islam to change into? Now, feminists such as Asma Barlas, Ziba Mir Husseini, and others openly write that they're trying to, and I quote, reconcile Islam with modernist conceptions of justice, feminist theories, Western conceptions of human rights, and contemporary Western ethics. In other words, they're not acting as interpreters of the text, but rather as secular liberal interpolators, in some ways missionaries. Now, instead of reviving classical Islamic understanding and inspiring creative liberators in the Muslim world, we see such feminists unfortunately trying to strip away the Islamic mechanics and safeguards for justice. And instead of helping Muslim society out from its post-colonial backwardness, which it is in and is facing a lot of problems because of, such feminists seem instead to be trying to complete the colonial project by pushing for the full imitation of Western ideologies. Now, this is not compatibility, brothers and sisters. This is a forced marriage and followed by a forced conversion. Now, Amina Wadud also talked about the frustrations that Muslim feminists feel when they have to pretend to argue feminism from an Islamic perspective and not a secular liberal perspective. So she writes in her book, the executive director of Sisters in Islam, Zaina Anwar, once asked, why can't we say we are working for gender justice from a human rights perspective instead of our earlier claim of working for a gender-inclusive Islamic perspective? And Amina Wadud commented, quite honestly, I understand the frustrations. So in other words, feminists seem to want to bring Muslims towards secular liberalism in the same way that sometimes missionaries from other religions will use the Quran to try to bring Muslims to other religions. Now, where exactly do these secular liberal values lead us, if that's where they're trying to take us? So let's look at what they consider to be the utopia, their vision of what the West actually is. Now, in the UK, where has 100 years of feminism led to? It's led to a lot of unintended consequences. So today, women receive preferential treatment in the criminal justice system with lighter sentences, preferential domestic violence support and cancer research, despite statistics showing that men are often vulnerable at similar or higher rates. It's led to education gaps, with women excelling ahead of men at universities and in entry to employment. It's led to women being liable to pay alimony to ex-husbands in the event of divorce. And the individualistic denial of mutual legal rights and duties between men and women in marriage has led to a frustration and isolation for both genders. And it's led to rising divorce rates. Women are socially and economically compelled to work. It's not out of choice. And often socially compelled by the fashion industry and the media to dress in revealing clothing and sexualize their appearance in order to be validated by society. Men can sleep with women without any legal commitment, and so many are now turning away from marriage, and women have to provide for themselves. So if anything, it could be argued that men might be happier here in the West than they would be in these so-called patriarchal Muslim countries. Domestic violence also continues to exist in shocking proportions, including against men and including amongst lesbian couples as well. And men and women both continue to be judged according to their gender rather than their merit. So is this what Muslim feminists are proposing or advocating for the Muslim world? Now, going back to the text, we encounter the fundamental problem with feminist interpretation. If we point to the Quran or Hadith as evidence for why Islam and feminism conflict, many feminists will simply reply, those texts are metaphorical, they're not to be understood literally, or the texts are historical, they're only for that time, they're not for this time, despite those verses being mubeen, which means clear or unambiguous. Now, seeing as the Quran and Hadith, which I've talked about this evening, are fundamental to Islam, and seeing how Muslim feminists make excuses for rejecting these texts today or openly admitting to saying no to them, simple common sense would dictate that Islam and feminism are conflicting. But seeing how Muslim feminists seem to remain unfazed by this, I propose that we need a falsification test for this topic. And that is that if feminists don't consider the Quran and Hadith conflicting with Islam to mean that Islam conflicting with feminism, to mean that Islam conflicts with feminism, then what would be sufficient evidence to show that Islam and feminism are conflicting? If it's not the Quran and Hadith, what else is there left to show conflict? What evidence would they accept without making these excuses? Now, I invite you all this evening to think about what conflict would look like, and other than overly wishful thinking, have we not already witnessed this conflict between Islam and feminism? Thank you for your time.
I'm going to post questions from our four subtopics, which is Islamic feminism, Quran and Hadith, polygamy, and hijab. I'm going to post each panel with one question on the same topic, but not same question. And the order to answer the question is according to the order of me posing the question. So on Islamic feminism, I'll start with Zara. If Islam is all encompassing and just to women and men, why are all the prophets, most imam, clerics, judges, as well as you see in practices, for example, legal structure, four women are equal to one man as a witness? You know, this evidence are very much male-centric, and does this not show that female are subjugated in Islam?
So I guess this question is something that we hear frequently. Why do you need, for example, four male witnesses who attest to certain things,
equals,
this is coming to my next point actually. Why do you need two female witnesses to equal one male witness? Now, if you are familiar with a lot of the rulings in Islam, you'll know that there are situations in which you need four male witnesses to equal one female witness. For example, in accusations of zina or fornication, if you have someone accusing the woman, they need four male witnesses to equal that one woman's testimony. So there are many scenarios in which it depends on the circumstance, it depends on the situation. In matters, for example, of childbirth or things which women at the time tended to be more familiar with, you didn't need two female witnesses. It was just sort of, one female witness, and sometimes you might even need two male witnesses. With regards to when you did need two female witnesses, this was purely in relation to commercial transactions. So the verse where you'll find this is purely in relation to commercial transactions. So it says to the people, when you are engaging in a transaction, be sure to write it down. That's the first thing. So it's giving kind of the completion requirements for doing any kind of contract. And because women at the time were not as involved in commercial and transactional affairs, it said, to have two female witnesses if you can't find two men, so you have one male and two women. Now, I think the problem that people encounter when they hear about, why do you need two women to equal one man? There's a lot of misconceptions about Islam's opinion on women's intellectual capacity, or what Islam says about women's intellectual capacity. Now, in Islam, a woman can be in any position of authority. There's only one that you can't be in, and that's the role of the caliph, for example. I'll explain what I mean if you'll allow. A woman in Islam can be a judge, she can be an advisor to a ruler, she can be a teacher, she can be in any role. And there are plentitude of examples from the prophetic tradition and ever since then. You had an advisor to the caliph who the caliph very much valued her opinion. And you had the woman who was the in authority of the marketplace, so she was basically the regulator of the market, a very public arena, yet she was a woman, she was valued for her intellect, and women were not held back from these roles, and it also wasn't considered something special that, a woman is doing this role. It was taken as a given. Why wouldn't she do this role? It wasn't glamorized. It was kind of socialized norm at the time. Now, the only reason that, for example, the woman can't be in the role of the caliph is a very sort of, it's a practical reason. The first is that the role of the ruler is essentially not anyone special. It doesn't matter who the ruler is. The system is agreed upon by the people. The ruler is there purely to administer the role. So this idea that somehow putting a woman in the position will change the way things work doesn't really translate. For example, in Pakistan, where you didn't even have an Islamic system, you had Muslims, and it's very much a secular country. But having, you know, a female ruler didn't improve conditions for women at all. Similarly, in other countries, having a female ruler alone does not improve the conditions. What matters is the governance and the system that is agreed upon, and the ruler is purely the administrator. So the first thing is we shouldn't be obsessed with, oh, why can't women be rulers? Because it's irrelevant. If you agree on what needs to be done, it doesn't really matter. And secondly, the role of the caliph as a male is purely because as the male, they would also be the commander of sort of the army and be expected to go into battle. And so because women are not legally obliged to be conscripted in Islam, you're not legally obliged to fight, although you could do so voluntarily if you were in a Muslim country and they had an army. However, because it's not an obligation on you, the state can't also call on you to be a leader. So it's purely an exemption rather than a restriction. However, as I mentioned, because the woman can be in a capacitor of the capacity of an advisor, and because who the ruler is doesn't really matter, it's a non-issue. It's been generally a non-issue for Muslims.
But we don't see that translated in a very dominated Muslim society, whereas women are being positioned. No, you don't lead, let the men lead. And yeah, it's so ingrained that it affects a lot.
Yeah.
The public.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, that concerns a lot of people. So what do you have to say?
So the sister's bringing up very acute and correct observation that in the Muslim world today, this is not what we see. And this is correct, this is not what we see. So you know how I mentioned in my presentation about how the Muslim world today is essentially a post-colonial mess. It is really a mess. And this is not how Islam is supposed to be practiced. There is interest banking, there is corruption, there is lying, there is, you know, people struggling. Their only currency is so-called honor and reputation. It's become very tribal. It's become very unlearned. It is not attached to the classical traditions anymore. It's come very far from that. And I think we shouldn't look to the Muslim world as an example for how Islam should be. We should look at Islam and its historical practice, its successful practice in the past, for how to re-implement this. And in the Muslim countries, in the Muslim world, that is what needs to be revived. The classical understandings, reconnecting people in a lively and dynamic way to the classical scholarship, and making sure that the governance and all the infrastructure is put in place properly so that those things can be seen through, so that people's rights and duties can be protected, and so that you are not having people being exploited for, you know, you owe me this duty, do this, while, you know, everything else is, you know, going to hell. It doesn't really make sense. So, for example, how did the Arab Spring start in the Muslim world? It was a man who was so frustrated with the political and economic condition and circumstance. He was so frustrated, one of hundreds of thousands, because he couldn't provide for his family with honor and dignity. He was just trying to make a living and provide for, you know, his wife and children and family. He was so frustrated at the tyranny and corruption that he set himself on fire. Now, we didn't say this is a men's rights issue. We didn't say this is a family issue. We recognize that this is anarchy in the Muslim world. There is tyranny and there is corruption. So we can't look at the Muslim world and isolate problems and look at them individually. We have to look at the bigger picture in order to provide a holistic solution and make sure that the groundwork is there rather than the piecemeal implementation of one or two implementations. It doesn't really work like that.
I'll get back to you, Marina. Mm-hmm. So my question on Islamic feminism will be, this embracing feminism means we have to assess the entire Islamic jurisprudence, or in other words, usul fiqh, the practices, conventions. Do you think if we adhere to feminism, Islamic feminism per se, do we need to change some means of practicing Islam?
No, I don't think so, because I think Islam by itself, there is no problem. And by the way, it's very interesting, but I agree with everything that Zahra has just said. Because it's absolutely true that, it shouldn't be an issue who is there and all that. But there is who is the leader, who is the teacher, whoever. It shouldn't be an issue. But there is this thing called unconscious bias. I think you've heard of it, where
people are so ingrained into thinking that only certain people can do be certain things. And we've just had an interesting, I don't know whether you all follow Malaysian news, but we just had this interesting thing where a couple of years ago, the Malaysian National Fatwa Council said that women could be Sharia judges. Now, this is partly a practical, practical thing. Because, as you know, there are more female students in our universities than there are male. There are 70% now. And that includes in Islamic studies. So there are actually more women coming out, you know, graduating from Islamic studies than there are men. So naturally, they are going to go into, you know, the religious departments and all that. And they're going to go up the ranks. And after a while, the most qualified people to be judges are the women. So the National Fatwa Council said, yeah, it's fine, you know, for them to be judges. And so a couple of years ago, they appointed the first two women Sharia judges. And they announced that we've just appointed them. The men all freaked out because, like, they didn't realize that it was happening, I think. And then they immediately said, oh, okay, they can be judges, but they can't be judges in the divorce cases because they might be biased. Why? We don't know, you know. But it was kind of too late already because they were already appointed. They had the letters of appointment and all that. So anyway, so that's that was okay. And then since then there have been more judges. But recently, a couple of days ago, actually, the head of the National Fatwa Council commented that some states are still refusing to appoint women as Sharia court judges. And he wanted to know why, because they are very qualified, they have higher, CPGA? You know, this is very American, right? American style, I don't understand. But anyway, better than the guys. And so why can't they appoint these women as Sharia court judges? So today, he particularly pointed out Selangor, Selangor State, which is Jais, you know, Maiz, very problematic state. I'll go into that later. But today, Maiz, the head of Maiz, Majlis Agama Islam Selangor, came out and said, yeah, we'll appoint them, but only in family matters and things like that, and not in the criminal cases, Sharia criminal, under the Sharia Criminal Offences Act. Fine. At least they considered that much. It was better than from zero. So, you know, there is that bias where it's not necessarily Islamic, as you pointed out. There's no real reason to not have these women because they are qualified, but yet they didn't want to appoint them until now. They're being pushed by a man, by the way, not any of us. So, you know, now they're being pushed into a position where they have to appoint women Sharia court judges. And you get a lot of these cases all over the time. Sometimes not even just from men, but also from women. Like we had this Adun, state assemblywoman from Perak, who said that women could not be Menteri Besar or Chief Minister of the state because there are a lot of religious functions that she has to perform with the Sultan, and she couldn't do that because she's a woman. Now, in the job description of being Chief Minister of a state, I'm not sure that religious functions with the Sultan is number one. I'm sure it's about administering the state properly, making sure it's developed, and ensuring that, you know, the well-being of people in the state, etc., etc., which is pretty much gender neutral. You know, it is, as you said, it's about governance, right? It's whether you're going to be a good governor or not. It doesn't matter whether you're male or female. But there's this woman saying that you couldn't, just because you can't perform the religious duties, which take up maybe, you know, 5% of your time as MB. So, you know, it's things like this. You know, where does this come from? Where does this type of thinking come from? Is it Islamic? In fact, I have a tendency to agree with Zara that actually it comes from a colonial past that we haven't quite shaken off. Because, you know, a lot of our laws, Malaysia, the codified religious laws, actually came from the Brits. The Brits came and codified our laws. Before that, actually, women in the Malay Peninsula, because of course when they came over 100 something years ago, it was not Malaysia yet. Women had a lot of rights. They could go and complain to the village head if they had a problem with their husband, their own property, etc., etc. Then the Brits came, and as Brits do, they like to codify laws, which means they like to write it all down, right? So they decided that, okay, all these customary laws that are out there, we have to put it down. We have to write it down. Now, when they wrote it down, don't forget, this was in Victorian times. Some of the things that, when they tried to codify it, they brought in their own beliefs and biases and all that into it. How many of you watched Downton Abbey? Hey, a guy, blah. You all don't watch, ah? Downton Abbey, you know the premise of Downton Abbey, right? The premise is that this guy, Lord Grantham, has got all these daughters who they own this wonderful mansion, right? This beautiful mansion. It's very important who these daughters marry, right? Because in Victorian times, when a woman married, her property goes to the husband, right? So, in our country, in Malaysia, that was not the case. But the colonial officers who were codifying our laws couldn't believe this. Like, how can a woman administer her own property? So it must go to the husband. So they couldn't quite believe this. And today, you know, one of the things that all of us Muslim women grow up with is that if whatever our fathers give us, whatever our family gives us, you know, our property, when we get married, it's still ours, right? So that has been in our family laws for the longest time. Up till 1984, we had the best family laws in the world. And that was one of the things that was pretty much central, you know, for Muslim women, that we own our own properties. But now it has been changed in the name of gender neutrality, so that now, if a Muslim couple gets divorced in Malaysia, that property that you bring to the marriage, which should remain yours, it's counted as harta sepencarian, which is, in English, matrimonial property.
I don't speak Malaysian, but
you can guess. Matrimonial property, and then you split that, you have to divide it by half. So what you bring? So this was the Lord Grantham problem, right? Suddenly you have it there, and this is not, you know, and this is a problem because it comes from a bias that translates into law and public policy. And that's a big problem for a lot of women now in Malaysia. I mean, we can talk about the theoretical. The theory is great. You know, the theory is great. Muslim women, when Islam came, they're entitled to have their own property. But now suddenly, they have to give it up because of these laws that are written down. So, you know, I blame the Brits. But the thing is that there are some people now defending this type of laws and saying Islamic, we cannot change. But the fact is that it's been changed several times. 1984, we really had great Muslim family laws in Malaysia. I can't speak for other countries. But it has been changed over time so that we Muslim women actually have lost a lot of it. And the trouble is, we live in a multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. And we have a constitution that is supposed to apply to every citizen in Malaysia. But the fact is that for non-Muslim women, they have been gaining rights over these years, while we have been losing. And that is, you know, doesn't gel to me. If you're equal under this constitution, but you have different rights, and we are losing these rights, it is not. It's actually, I think, un-Islamic. You know, what else can I say? Because there is no justice for Muslim women. And I can tell you so many stories from our experiences of the women that come to us who are really suffering. It's you know, when it translates into law and public policy, when it's implemented, then human biases and beliefs and all that come into play. And how it plays out in real life causes a lot of unhappiness, causes a lot of injustice, etc. Okay.
Could I add to this something? So I'm glad that you agree that, you know, the inheritance laws should, you know, the Islamic inheritance law is kind of better. But I guess what concerns me is, I was looking, for example, at the, maybe you could comment, if you want, you don't have to comment, but I was looking at, for example, the Musawa, which is one of the organizations to, you know, cultivate sort of feminism and stuff. I was looking at the toolkit and the framework that they have on the website, and some of the aims said, you know, equal rights, including like gender egalitarianism, including equal division of property, and they should have the same property rights as one another. And I found that a bit alarming compared with what you've explained today, because what does that mean? Does that mean where in Islam women get, you know, they get to keep all their property, but they only get half inheritance? Would equalizing it, are those individuals calling then that men should also get to keep all of their property and not have to provide? Or are they saying that, you know, women have to be the providers? Or are they saying that, you know, both parties get to keep their own property and not provide for each other? So this kind of thing, I think, is problematic and concerning. So if these are the kinds of proposals and values being put out there, I don't see how this will help some of the problems that you've just mentioned. So I agree that, you know, a lot of these the laws and the attitudes are from a Victorian era, sort of transported over, you know, thinking that the whole world needs this when it really doesn't. It did similar things in Malaysia, preventing women, for example, from you know, becoming doctors, whereas they used to before. Whereas the, you know, the colonial you know, guys would come along and say, you know, our women make do with male doctors, you can do the same. It's been the same throughout the Muslim world. So I think the response to this shouldn't be, let's, you know, for example, with regards to property and inheritance, I don't think it should be as some, what some of these organizations are, you know, honestly saying, which is that it should be divided and equal property rights for both, because that's exactly what the you know, has been the cause of some of these problems in the first place. So, I don't know, that's kind of, you know, I find it a bit striking that the comparison between what you've said, which is nice, but what, for example, some of the policies and aims of the organizations differ quite a bit.
Actually, they don't differ. It's what, you know, women have these rights and men have the rights. The trouble is, at least in the case of Malaysia, that the Muslim family laws have been amended to be so-called selectively gender neutral. Mm. What it means is that what was the rights of women have been given to the men, but what the men's rights have not been given to the women. If we were happy with status quo before, but now what happens is, for instance, before, if a man wanted to, according to our laws, again, I can't speak for other countries, say if a man wanted to take another wife, he had to explain to the court why he wanted to. He also had to prove to the court that the current wife's standard of living, family and all that would not deteriorate if he took another wife and all that. But all this have been amended so that now he has no obligation to make sure that the first family is cared for and all that. Plus, he is now allowed to take the property of the first wife and use it even to provide for the next wife. And we've had cases where the man actually froze the account of his first wife and left her with nothing just because he wanted to take another wife. So we have all these different things happening. And also, if you, I'm sure you know that in Malaysia, every state has its own religious laws. So in fact, every state, because it's a state responsibility, not a federal one. So in fact, we have 13 different variations of all these laws. So so the thing is, you know, there are all sorts of things. And when you talk about property, actually what you mean by property, you know, it's we talk about assets, right? Land or things like that in terms of property. But what has happened in Malaysia, again, is that they have extended the all this the Islamic way of dividing property, or they this extended the definition of property to things like EPF, to things like insurance. So if a man buys insurance, life insurance, and names, I mean, Muslim man, names his wife as beneficiary, which is what the intention is. You buy insurance so that you make sure that after he passes away, the wife has something, you know, to have something after. That is now subjected to faraid. So insurance. EPF also. EPF, you're supposed to put down beneficiary. You cannot put down your wife as the you can beneficiary. The wife and daughters can only be I forget the word, something like trustees. You know, so they don't they can't actually get it. They can only, then it has to be divided by faraid. And we've had lots of cases where male relatives, brothers, uncles, or whatever of the deceased, have swooped in and taken it away. Even property. We had this woman who husband died, and his brothers came and took over the house that she had lived in all her married life, and kicked her out of it because they had a right to take it, and she was left homeless. So these type of cases, are the things that, you know, worries a lot of women, and when it is justified in the name of Islam, it's very worrying because it's patently unjust. Mm-hmm. And how could you know, throwing people out onto the street be considered Islamic? And that's the real life problems that we have to deal with.
Just very briefly, okay. Very, very briefly. Hopefully people are finding it interesting. I don't know. It seems, again, from some of the issues you described, the solution is to enforce and reinforce that actually the Islamic division of property, not equal division, all these other sort of equal rights sort of language that comes out of organizations that, you know, talk about this, like Musawa.
You're proposing this. Misleading.
I'm proposing it is misleading, because what it sounds like, if you say that men and women should have equal property rights, you're making it sound like you're not talking about Islamic property rights. You're not specifying women should be allowed to keep their property untampered. You're not saying that this is what you want to be protected and enforced. And you're also opening the floodgates to all kinds of interpretations, which gives rise to some of the problems you mentioned with regards to insurance and these kinds of non-physical type, intangible types of wealth, these issues. And the other thing is, obviously, nobody should be thrown out of their home. Obviously. Islamically, for example, you know, in an Islamic governance or Islamic state, it's actually the responsibility of the government to make sure that there is no one in that position where they would have to kind of be exposed to the elements and have to, you know, be on the streets. So if Islamically a woman no longer has, what is known as a wali amr, or a guardian, or someone who is administratively responsible for where she lives, then the state steps into that role and should be protecting her. So where you have in Muslim countries women being thrown out or women facing these problems, again, these are not from Islam. These are problems of structure, problems of governance. And I think that organizations should be advocating purely the Islamic injunctions in terms of property rights, in terms of marital rights, rather than calling on, because it sounds nice to some people, you know, these words, equality and egalitarianism, without actually explaining what they mean, mm-hmm. without actually explaining what is meant when using them. So I think this is one of the, you know, one of the causes of the problems. And by calling for those same values, we are going to exacerbate the problems.
Okay. Well, actually, I think we are responding to these problems. I mean, it wasn't because we were calling for equal rights that they had this fatwa for EPF or for insurance. It happened, you know, because it just happened. Somebody somewhere decided that this was done. So. You know, we are responding to very real problems that women have. I think, yes, I agree with you. The state should come down hard on people who throw women out of their homes and throw families out of their homes, etc. But the thing is, they don't. So if they don't, who is going to take up this problem? Us. You know, we have to fight for this rights. You can, you know, and we are pointing out that it is un-Islamic to throw people out of their homes.
I'm sorry to cut you, but I think I need to proceed with other questions.
Sure.
I'm so sorry.
So we just let it naturally flow.
Yeah. I'm so sorry.
Sorry.
So you spoke about interpretation. So Quran and Hadith is the big issue here. Do you think Muslim women should have political power to say that their version of the interpretation is right?
So the question, for anyone that didn't catch it, is should women have the political power to say that their interpretation is correct, you know, compared with others? Now, I think first of all, there's two things which should not be relevant. The first is the gender of the person, and the second is political power. The purpose of interpreting Quran is to understand what was God's will, to understand the intention of God in how we're supposed to be, you know, living our lives. Now, what that means is you have to be, first of all, if you are trying to interpret what that means, you should be a qualified mujtahid. And it's irrelevant what your gender is, but what is relevant is if you are biased, if you have a political agenda, or if you have a certain angle or skew that could mean that you might read into it things which are not there, then that makes someone questionable. And I don't think it's about, you know, whether it's male or female, whether they should have the political power or not. I think we need to revive scholarship generally. So we have a decline in scholarship generally throughout the Muslim world. I think it's irrelevant whether we have more female scholars or male scholars. If they are true to the goal of interpreting and understanding what God's will was and not bringing into it other trying to read into it, like I mentioned in my presentation, and trying to marry it up with other ideologies, which kind of defeats the purpose, then there's no problem with a woman being a mujtahid or this kind of thing. And again, we have to be cautious of, I guess, when we say, oh, women have the political power to interpret or to pose their interpretation as correct, it shouldn't be that they have to be in a political position. So there are, you know, some narrations and instructions that if the scholar is at the foot or at the step of the ruler, they're probably, you know, they're not really to be trusted, because if you have political goals and a political agenda, then you're not going to be objective in your work. And one of the, you know, problems in the Muslim world today, scholarship is in massive decline. So if you imagine, just to make this a little bit more close to anybody that doesn't have familiarity with a Muslim country or has not spent time in a Muslim country or have familiarity with the background generally, just imagine if, you know, how in England we have hundreds and hundreds of years of English law jurisprudence. It's very refined. It's very, you know, complicated. There's legislation, there's case law. You have to understand which case, you know, overrules which case, all this kind of stuff. Now, imagine if you had an occupying force come and take over your country and prevent you from studying your legal past and prevent you from continuing that legal past, so that all you are left with is the bare basics, the bare rudimentary basics of what your legal system used to be. You can't engage with it in a sophisticated way anymore. And this is essentially what happened as a result of post-colonialism in the Muslim world. And so these days, scholars are very much imitating past things that they used to do, whereas sometimes, you know, the method of that is no, the style of having those rulings today, you know, the way you implement them may no longer sort of work. You may have to change the style of implementation, not what the ruling actually says, but the style of it itself. And when people are so distant from the classical scholarship and understanding why and having the infrastructure in place, this is what leads to some of the problems and leads to people thinking that they need to be in positions of political power to force a certain interpretation. And I think this is a dangerous path to go down, to mix political power with, particular interpretations. Rather, we need a sincere revival of Islam in the Muslim world, not looking at the gender of the scholars, not looking at things through gender biased lenses. So not looking at things through sort of, in Arabic we use the word asabiyya, which means like tribalism or nationalism, or basically an arbitrary feeling of, oh, this person is the same gender as me, so we are together. No, this is irrelevant. It is irrelevant. We should agree upon Islamic conceptions of justice and the actual revival of that and how to bring that about. That is more important than these kinds of identity politics and this kind of thing.
So I think I'll just, because we're running out of time, so I think I will need to rush it a bit.
I just want to say that I agree so much with what Zara has said. Yes, this sort of political agenda with a lot of, I agree that we need more scholarship that is seriously lacking in Muslim countries, even at the most basic level, actually. It's really sad. So we need a lot more of that. And also the conflation of a lot of religion with politics these days, with political agendas, has really caused a lot of disruption in many of our countries. And in Malaysia, I can give you numerous examples. I know Malaysian students here all know. So it's kind of... I totally agree with you. We need some sort of
clear
revival to, you know, get back to the basics in a way.
Okay, I think I need to ask questions on polygamy and hijab. Very controversial within respect to female. Do you think polygamy devalues women? That's for polygamy. And for hijab, hijab meaning headscarf or head covering, was firstly done by Prophet's wife. What arguments, I mean, within context of Islam, what argument do we have to extend this to the greater public?
Okay, do you want me to go first?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess I'll start with the hijab one because it's very straightforward. So the sister was saying that, you know, the verses were originally directed at the wives of the Prophet. So what explanation do we have for rolling this out to everyone? And I think it's very simple. So the Quran actually states itself, tell the believing women to cover in a certain way so that they may be recognized and not molested. So it's addressing, in that verse, it's addressing all believing or Muslim women. So it's not restricting it to the wives of the Prophet. And the verses that it uses are, for example, the specific term that it uses for the covering is often a subject of discussion for many people. So it uses the term khimar in one verse, which means at the time they would wear the khimar, which is the head cover. However, they would not have it coming down, they would have it going back behind their shoulders. So basically would expose the front of them. And so the verse says to tell them to bring their khimars and also basically cover the chest area. So this verse describes not just general, some people say, oh, it just refers to general covering.
There was no clear outline of, most people argue that there was no clear outline of what is aura and what's not aura.
Right. So if we, yeah, exactly. So, but if you look at the precise word, it tells you, and people at the time would wear the head cover, so you would take it on that basis that seeing as they were wearing that, it extends to, you know, further beyond that. And also there are numerous narrations or ahadith or prophetic traditions which describe it further. So for example, the Prophet, peace be upon him, instructed that, you know, the only thing that should be seen is the face and the hands. So, you know, implying that the head also, you know, should be covered. So I think that one's pretty, you know, pretty straightforward. With regards to polygamy and whether it devalues, is that the word? Devalues women. Now, I do want to point out that for many, many people, polygamy is consensual. For many people, some people prefer it. Some people find that it works for them. In some societies, it is more common and they find that it works for them. In other societies, it is not, and so they tend not to do it. Now, Islamically, you are allowed, when you get married, to stipulate in your contract whether you're going to put up with that or not. So if the guy says, I'm going to, you know, at some point, take second wife, she can point to the contract and say, well, if you are, this is what's going to happen. Now, Islam gives you that choice. It gives you that, you know, that room to specify that, and that is your prerogative. If it is consensual, then there is no, there should be no objection to it. There should be no rancor towards it. If someone wants to do that voluntarily, good for them. It's interesting because a recent Gallup poll in America found that increasingly, Americans are thinking that polygamy is not such a bad thing. And they're saying that they prefer the idea of polygamy to the idea of an unfaithful person in a monogamous marriage. So they prefer the idea of polygamy to obviously being cheated on. Now, again, it's up to people what they want to opt in for and what they prefer. And
just to add on to that, it seems like because polygamy was sent down to a culture where Arabic culture back then, they were so polygamous, that's more than four wives or four husbands at a time. And then Islam came, narrowed
down. To restrict
to four. Mm. But now you see most people are monogamous, but then it seems being used to counter.
The other way. Well, I think, to be honest, there's any number of reasons why someone might want to think it's a, you know, might think it's a good idea to, if they want to take a second wife and the first wife is okay with it, the Quran allows it. So it's not for me or anybody to sit here and say you are not allowed to do it, you know, provided that they, according to the verse, treat them equally if they can, you know, and if they're happy with that arrangement, you know, that's fine. So if the Quran permits it, you know, for whatever reason, it's not for us to say you should not be doing this if they fulfill the requisite, you know, the requisite conditions. So whilst it came to restrict the number of wives that people had at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, you know, there could be any number of reasons. You might want to take a second wife because you just would like to. You might because there is a social benefit in that. You might for any number of reasons. So I think sometimes when we look at these provisions, we can dehumanize them when we analyze them, and we can say, how can a man take so many wives? Like, this is abhorrent, this is unacceptable. But we forget that people are human beings, and, you know, the complexities of life are immense. You can have, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why someone might do that. You know, provided it's consensual, I don't think anybody should have a problem with it. It's interesting because I was reading the other day how even there are some same gender couples known as thruples, because there's three of them, and there was there's one lesbian thruple in Massachusetts and one gay thruple in Thailand, and they basically got a lawyer to write down all the things that would happen in an Islamic contract, because obviously the law is not flexible for them at the time, but basically to mimic a marriage. Now, it seems that sometimes people are okay with polygamy, but when Muslims do it, it's like a big, you know, oh, how could you're so barbaric and, you know, so careless and thoughtless. Whereas, you know, I think we should realize that what Islam has permitted for men and women, polygamous, you know, if man wants to take more than whatever, you know, one wife, up to four, if it's consensual And if it's not my preference, it's not some other people's preference, it's irrelevant. If it's their preference, Islam permits it. That's the end of the story as far as I'm concerned.
Do you have anything to add on?
I completely agree. In the Quran, it allows polygamy. As long as you can treat, the man can treat all his wives equally,
but
fairly.
How do we know whether it's fair or not?
Well, this is the thing. you know, the theory of it is great, and it's always consensual because, you know, they is usually suka sama suka, mutual liking, and therefore you get married. But how does it actually translate into real life? My organization, SIS, we did a study on the impact of polygamy on families in Malaysia. So we interviewed more than 1,000 respondents, husbands, first wife, second wife, children of first wife, children of second wife. And it's turned out to be very interesting because the principles of, you know, fairness and all that were simply not there in real life. It might be the first wife, of course, married, mutual consent, of course, with the husband. He married the second wife, also mutual consent. But the first wife didn't approve. Mm-hmm. So she didn't know about it. You know, we had laws, like I said, in 1984. We had really very good laws about this, which protected the women. So, like, the man couldn't marry another one without the signed consent of the first wife. So she always knows about it, and she has to consent. So her consent is needed, the second wife's consent is needed. Over the years, it got amended that he no longer needed the...
What is the reason for that?
Well, who knows? Because these laws are made not with a lot of discussion or consultation with people, but, you know, very quietly done. That's why in 2005, when they were amending the Muslim family laws, which would have even reduced the protection of women in these laws, we kicked up a stink. And the government said must pass it, but they won't gazette it, which means it doesn't become law, pending further consultations with all interested parties, all that, which they have done, but they have not tabled it back to Parliament. And just as an example, you know, before, all these marriages had to be in front of a judge, and the second marriages or third marriages, whatever, and the man had to prove that it was just and necessary. Yeah, just meaning just to the existing wife and family, and necessary to have this other wife. They amended just one little word, which was they changed the word "and" to "or". And so now, he just has to prove it's necessary. Takut telanjur is very afraid of overstepping the bounds, meaning that he felt himself at risk of zina, you know. So that was the name. But whether it was just to the first wife, all became irrelevant. And so, you know, this type of things were happening. And in our study, we found that, you know, fairness to all the wives means providing equally to all the wives. What we found was that very often the first wives felt that they suffered a loss in living standards because the man's income is the same. And he now has to divide it into two families, right? And so the first wife is forced to go out and work to sell kueh or restaurant. And sometimes we found that actually the man was hardly working because all his wives were working and supporting their own families and supporting him. We found one man who had four wives, 22 children, and his salary was 2,200 ringgit.
What is that in pounds?
Divide by 6. So, you know, if you can't live here, you know, you can't live, even in Malaysia, you can't live on that, and that salary. So the wives all had to go out and work in order to survive. right? And this is really a complete, I think, distortion of what it was meant to be, what is in the Quran and all that, and yet they carry on. So these are the sort of things that we point out, because we get a lot of women coming to us
complaining
about these things, you know, that, you know, why suddenly, you know, my life has gone completely upside down because he wants to have another wife for, and another. And each time their living standards went down. One of the things that we did with this study, which hasn't been done before, was that we talked to the children
of
the first and the second, the children of the first wife and second wife. And because we could only interview people who are adults, 18 and above, some of them were quite old already, had married and had children. They were like 40, over 50 years old. But the pain they carry throughout their lives was still there.
The emotional
pain, yeah, that they felt. That there was a girl who said that when she went to meet her father to ask for money for her education, he said, "And you are from which mother again?" So he didn't know, even his own children. Surely this is not what is intended to do, right? The family is the basic unit of society. It's supposed to be harmonious and happy and all that. But if this causes, in real life, this causes so much pain and hurt and injustice, surely that, you know, we're not saying eradicating it, but surely we should put in the type of protections for women that, and children, that prevents this from happening. And you know, despite, just one more thing, despite the fact that it's allowed, a lot of men hide the fact that they have other wives. And unfortunately for first wives and children, they often discover this upon his death. We've had so many cases of suddenly at the funeral, this whole other family turns up. And the worst thing is that some of the kids are already quite grown up, which means he's hidden it for so long. And, you know, the anguish and the pain and things that comes at an already sad time, and then the fights over inheritance and all that, it's really, you know. So I think what we are trying to say is that, yes, it's allowed. Yes, there are good reasons for it, but when there is abuse of it, and it really is abuse, you know, then we have to do something, because, you know, it does not protect the dignity of the family or the dignity of the woman, etc., etc.
Okay,
I would just add to it. Very important.
Can I open the question to the public?
Yeah, and then I'll just comment on.
Yeah, very sorry.
I just think it's really important to realize that all of these problems that Marina talked about, just to point out that they're not because of polygamy itself. They are because of the lack of infrastructure, the lack of ability for maybe Muslim women to go to courts and say, my husband is neglecting. He's neglecting, you know. If you're suddenly, your standard of living drops because he's taken a second wife, this is grounds to go to the court and have him sort of, you know, pulled up on that. To go to the court and say, he's not fulfilling his duties anymore, X, Y, and Z. He gets dragged into court. This is what should happen. And the judge says, you know, watch yourself. What are you doing? You know what I mean? So this is the kind of thing which is lacking. It's not because of polygamy. It's not because of polygamy itself, but rather the failure to implement the surrounding infrastructure properly. And I think that's important to understand. And if we take away, I know you're saying you wouldn't ban it or restrict polygamy itself, but sometimes people do call for this. And I just want to point out that if you take it away, you are opening up the floodgates to, you know how I mentioned earlier about how Americans said they would prefer polygamy to infidelity, basically. I think if you take it away, you do open up those floodgates. You open up the floodgates for people to take, you know, to have extramarital affairs, to be forced to do that, where it's completely in secret and it's completely out of the mind's eye. So I think it's important not to say we have problems as a result of polygamy, let's get rid of polygamy. No, this is not going to work, that's going to make it worse. You'll end up with much bigger problems in society where, you know, upon the death, the children will turn up, you know, from illegitimate arrangements and have absolutely no rights whatsoever. So I think that is an important thing to bear in mind.
But that is exactly what we are fighting for. The infrastructure just simply is not there. We've had a lot of cases where the judges have ordered husbands to pay maintenance, and then they cannot implement at all. And the wives have to go up and down to the court to you know, get them to please, you know, get the husbands to follow the court orders. Actually, it's contempt of court. But for women, it's tough when they have less money to, you know, to take leave from work to go to court, etc., etc. It is absolutely the infrastructure that is problem, and that's exactly what we have been talking about and fighting for. Get the infrastructure right. Because then it is just. But, you know, this is what is happening every day. And women, a lot, I mean, we have lots of single mothers in Malaysia, and they really, really have a lot to complain about, especially because this Malaysian Muslim family laws have a lot to do with infrastructure and the support mechanisms for all these cases, but they simply are not working, and therefore these women have a right to demand that they be improved.
We're running late, but if anyone has any questions,
because Marina hasn't spoken about the hijab
That's one from the back.
I have two questions. Firstly, Marina, what is your stand on Quranic reinterpretation? Because Zara was trying to get you in that direction for a while, and I think other feminists are quite clear, like they want to throw something up, and it seems like you're a bit agnostic, or I'm not sure. What is your stand? Can you make it clear? If there are certain verses that need to be reinterpreted, who does the reinterpretation? Is there any Tom, Dick, Harry, Martina can come and open the Quran and reinterpret or contextualize it? And what do you personally propose? And secondly, seems like if the problem is about infrastructure, then it's irrelevant to talk about Islamic feminism. Once we talk about Islamic feminism, what's that meaning? Once you talk about Islamic feminism, you're implying that there is a problem with Islam and not the infrastructure. So I don't see why, like, you're... By using that, I feel like you're putting Islam on trial. When it's an issue of authoritarianism, why don't we combat authoritarianism instead of talking about Islam?
Can we have another one, please? Yes.
So, in relation to the topic tonight, Muslim feminists, it's my personal question, but I also have a friend who has this similar sentiment. We are Muslim and we believe in what the ideas of feminism, what feminism actually tries to achieve, but we to some extent feel uncomfortable calling ourselves Muslim feminists. Okay. Do you think it's for both speakers, do you have any thoughts on first why do we have to have this label in the first place and actually, you know, be proud of it, and second, if it's actually problematic, where do we have to begin, you know, trying to address it? So, if really there is a problem, how do we make it not to be a problem for our own identity so we feel insecure for calling ourselves Muslim feminists?
Thank you.
It's a good question.
I think they're all mine or what? They're all depicted.
I can help you out with them. I'm interested to answer some of them as well. Okay. If you like.
But I think we just speed it up because the room is up until 9 and we have to leave. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So do you want me to?
Yeah, please, quickly.
Our friend over there asked about Quranic reinterpretation. I actually think that, you know, number one, I think the Quran, because we are only humans. Every time we read it, we are doing some interpretation already. So this interpretations are not always, is not something new. I think it's been going on for a long time. And yeah, no, I don't think that the man on the street should be doing the interpretation. Obviously, it has to be someone who is learned. And in fact, there are a lot of scholars who are looking at the Quran, and some of them are women, and they are looking at it and interpreting it in ways that are, you know, compatible. I don't know is that if that's the word, with modernity or whatever, because especially for women, the circumstances that we live in is really quite different. So how do we apply all those Quranic ethics and principles to the issues that we face now, right? That's one. So that's where I stand. When it comes to infrastructure, well, particularly in Malaysia, where we have two different court systems for family laws, so therefore there are two infrastructures, and what we deal with, Muslim women, is the Sharia court system. That is the infrastructure. And because there are so many problems with the infrastructure, and we are trying to point out that this infrastructure doesn't work, and they don't adhere to the Islamic ethics and principles that are in the Quran and in the Hadith and all that. Therefore, by default, we have to talk about Islam. And so it's not, we're not putting Islam in a bad light. I think we are probably putting the Islamic authorities, who are human beings, on the back foot. At least they are forced to be.
The issue is, these problems occur in non-Muslim countries. I mean, in Hollywood, they are talking about, in Hollywood, unequal pay for women, right? I mean, these infrastructural problems occur in all societies.
Yes, so, but I live in Malaysia, and you know, the people that I work with are Malaysians, Malaysian women. So, I mean, I can't do anything about Hollywood, but I can do something about my own country. So that's what I'm trying to do. Whether it works or not, I don't know. But you know, I can't just sit back and take it. So we have to do something. I mean, you know, so if someone wants to call it feminism, well, whatever. I think all sorts of labels are being thrown at us. In the state of Selangor, by the way, we are called deviant. And there is a fatwa against us that we are challenging in court. I don't know why exactly. They haven't told us why. The next question, why have the label at all Muslim feminist? Well, I think, you know, it kind of happened almost by default, because we are having to, you know, in the circumstances that we, you know, there are many types of feminists in the world. I mean, the trouble is the one that gets the biggest headlines and all that are Western feminists. Mm-hmm. And that has given, like, that has kind of colored the word all over the world, which is kind of unfortunate, because their problems, well, they came from a certain history. You know, if you saw suffragette, that was the history they came from, getting votes for women, getting equal pay and all that. It's an unending problem. It's still there, as you say. So, you know, they've got their own problems. They haven't finished with it. They've come a long way. And we still have to acknowledge something. In our own countries, we cannot now imagine that women cannot vote. Right? When we became independent in Malaysia in 1957, there was no such thing as not giving women the vote. We had to give the vote. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Right? That's one. And also the idea that you shouldn't get paid the same amount if you did the same work as a man also doesn't work, right? So that we owe it to them. However, we have our own special issues because of our own cultures and traditions, and we know how to solve it ourselves. So we don't need them to come and tell us what to do. Unfortunately, there's a bit bad habit lah, that they all like to tell us what to do, and so we also are not that keen on all these Western feminists. On the other hand, there are also a lot of secular feminists in many Muslim countries, rabidly secular feminists who think that there is absolutely no reason to talk about religion because religion is personal, and therefore there is no, you know, just keep them out of it. It's inherently patriarchal. Therefore, never mind, you know, keep it out of the discourse. But when in countries like Malaysia, religion becomes the source of law and public policy, then we have to talk about it. Besides the fact that religion is important to a lot of us. So how can you ignore it altogether? So that's where we come from. That we are kind of in the middle, where we are completely, we are not at all secular. That's one thing. We believe in our faith. We believe that our faith, that, you know, which is in this case Islam, is a just religion. We believe that God is just. So therefore, when we see unjust things happening in our society, number one, we don't attribute it to God being unjust. We attribute it to humans being unjust. And therefore, we as human beings have an obligation, a responsibility to try and put it right.
I'm sorry to cut you.
So, yeah. So there's something very important that I want to say with regards to the term Muslim feminist or feminist or whatever. Now, what people often forget or seem to imagine is that you don't have to be a feminist to care about women's rights. Now, unfortunately, feminism has taken a kind of monopoly on the issue. And feminism is very highly ideologically charged. And so if you carry the passport, you end up carrying its baggage as well. So I think we should be very cautious and not use that label. Just leave it alone. If your call is to Islam, simply call for Islam and say that you are doing this as Muslims. And that is the best dawah you can do. And that is the best way to make your message more sweeter to the state, to the government, to whoever you are, advocating to. And I just want to say that this term, you don't have to feel that you have to use it. Take it back. Take back women's rights. Take back family law. Take back all these issues. Don't conflate it with these other ideologies. Don't let, you know, feminists in India and in other countries did a lot to actually take away Muslim women's rights. They thought that they were liberating them, but actually they made things a whole lot worse. So why do we want to associate ourselves with such a movement? Why? Why do we want to associate ourselves with those feminists who do call, as I mentioned in my opening presentation, who do call for the secularization, for the westernization, for the reformation of
Islam? That's not us. That's not us.
Some of them, do you know what? Some of them were from Sisters in Islam, and maybe they should come and clarify it if that's not what they mean. So
no, we've not said this. We are not at all secular.
So, you know, in my presentation, how I referred to, you know, some of them wanting to reconcile, and the majority of the presentation was about this. I would invite people to revisit it. But if that is not the case, then they should come out and say, do you know what we want? They shouldn't say we want, you know, Western concepts of justice or equality or all this. What I would advocate, and what I would invite brothers and sisters in the Muslim world, including your organizations, to advocate, is purely an Islamic-based system. Forget this dual law, forget these secular implementations, forget these, you know, strange concoctions and hybrid versions that we have in Pakistan. You have, basically, it is a secular system that has a few bits of Sharia. In Malaysia, you have a dual system where it's, you know, where it's conflicting and pulling at each other. Why? Just have a purely Islamic system. And the best example that I would point to for why this would work is actually Islam in practice when it was holistically practiced. So, for example, until as recently as 1924, you had the Ottoman Caliphate, and they were implementing it by and large holistically. Towards the end, it became what is known as the sick man of Europe. It developed, you know, a lot of issues towards the end. For the majority of its span, and caliphates before it, and Islamic systems before it, they had prosperity. So, for example, women in Ottoman Turkey, during the Ottoman Caliphate, of different religions. So it was very good at dealing with minorities as well, which is a problem in a lot of Muslim countries. So what the Ottomans did, as Muslim countries, Muslim states have always done, is they would allow, for example, different religious groups. They don't force them to conform to Islamic values. They wouldn't force them to do anything. You would have public laws that everybody would abide by. But for example, you would have the Christian quarter, the Jewish quarter, the Armenian quarter, where these religious communities could flourish and practice their beliefs without being forced to conform, like we have sometimes here. Muslims feel compelled to conform to British values, whatever that means. Whereas the Muslims would, you know, they would accommodate that these religious communities have their own courts and have their own governance. They would have a figure appointed amongst that community. They would be under the umbrella of the Ottomans, but they would be allowed to practice their faith. And women, although they had access to their own religious courts, they would prefer to go to the Islamic courts because they felt that they were more just to their needs than their own courts. And looking at this history, that is the best example to see how we should deal with the infrastructure in the Muslim world. What should it be like? Should we just be challenging sort of in a piecemeal way, you know, seeking band-aid solutions, a little bit here, a little bit there? No, I think that the change has to be holistic and systematic. And I would invite you, if you have time, to look up an article on this called Ottoman Women During the Advent of Western Feminism. And it compares the state of Muslim women in the Muslim world during the Ottoman Caliphate with the rise of feminism in the West, because it was happening at the same time. When Mary Wollstonecraft was writing in the West about, you know, the rights for women, women in Turkey already had all those rights. They were politically active. You would give the pledge, not the vote, because it wasn't that kind of system. They were, you know, women are they're involved politically, giving the pledge along with men. There is a quote there are many quotes from travel writers who visited the Ottomans during the caliphate, and they were astounded at the freedom and the liberation of women there. They didn't even see it as liberation, because they weren't being liberated. That's just the way that they lived. So, for example, they said, you know, as many, I've almost memorized it because I've told so many people, but one writer from England visited, and she wrote back saying, as many women, if not more than men, are to be seen going around in the streets doing their daily activities. And she said, I never saw a woman so much more liberated than those in Turkey. And she said that the men there are so good to their women. They are an example to all mankind. Now, that is what we need to be reviving in the Muslim world, that exemplary nature of Islam that accommodates different minorities, that safeguards the rights and duties of both men and women, that doesn't compromise on the laws, doesn't compromise on any of the Islamic values, but implements it, you know, holistically. It's not a utopia, of course, but it's what God has prescribed and what I think is the solution, not only in Pakistan and other Muslim countries, but in Malaysia as well. And that's where I will end. I'll end that.
And I comment. Marina, if you could have your views quickly on hijab.
Oh,
yeah.
We seem to be going back again.
No,
yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Because.
No, can yeah. I just. Yeah, I'm sorry, but to me it's kind of a non-issue, really.
Okay.
But to go back, no, I completely agree. You see, what a lot of people in Muslim countries, in Malaysia particularly, has forgotten is this rich history that we had, where women were free, where women had a role in public life and all that, and now we seem to be regressing. And that is what we are dealing with today. Mm-hmm. That, you know, despite the realities of life today, women are educated, more women in universities than there are men, women earning and sometimes earning more than men and all that. All this is happening in our country,
mm-hmm.
right? And women can do so many things. We have, all sorts of... We have a women governor of the central bank, head of the securities commission. We have women, Muslim women, in very, very high positions. But when it comes to the family laws, we seem to be regressing, and it is a problem of the infrastructure and all that. And I also think that somehow the designers of these laws and all that were very much influenced by Western notions of equality and inequality. They are absorbing that, and because there's a lot of confusion now, they you know, like I said, about the inheritance, but they're actually taking on a Western view of it and not and saying that is Islamic law. And when we say something, they say, oh no, you're wrong, you cannot changing. You know, we have all these issues. And if we went back to the glory days of Islam, where women did have a role to play, a very public role, a very good role and all that, we should revive that. But unfortunately, that's not what is happening. That is really not what is happening today in Malaysia. And yes, there's a lot of work to do, and that is the work that we are trying to do. And everyone is welcome to work for women in Malaysia, whichever group there is. But unfortunately, there's not very many working, in religion. And there are a lot, of course, of secular women's rights groups working for all Malaysian women, regardless of religion. But for us, particularly because of the issues that particularly Muslim women face, we have to do the advocating and whatever. So okay. It is a role that we take on, we can only dua that we will be successful.
Okay. So sorry, the event has to end. It's already at 9 and we have room booked until 9. Just to conclude everything, I would just like to thank everyone who come. I apologize that the Q&A session did not extend as long as I wanted to be, but the recording will be online on YouTube. We will post it on our Facebook page. Please do like us on Facebook and Twitter account. Thank you for attending, and thank you for the panel for being here.
Thank you.